This is the takeaway for Monday, July 13th. This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we're watching the deals pending in Vienna on the Iran nuclear program and what could be the real deal in Brussels to bail out Greece. Here's Christine Lagarde, head of the International Monetary Fund, one of the biggest Greek creditors.
It's been a laborious night, but I think it's a good step to rebuild confidence. And there will be many more steps, I'm sure, that will only be demonstrated by the implementation of what has been agreed now.
The bailout plan announced today is both heroic and puzzling, with billion-dollar questions everywhere. From Athens, Liz Alderman, chief European business correspondent for The New York Times, joins us. Liz, please describe for us this hard night of bargaining in Athens and Brussels.
Well, basically, the country of Greece and other European countries went to bed thinking that not only was there going to be no deal, but that quite possibly Europe was going to start dividing over this issue. And pretty early in the morning, there was an announcement that came out of Brussels indicating that a deal had been struck, with Mr. Tsipras, the Greek prime minister, pretty much capitulating to every demand, as well as more, that Germans and other northern countries had put forth over the night.
Can he make that call, since this deal was, it seems, refused last week by voters in Greece?
Yeah, I mean, it's really been a whirlwind over the last week. As you point out, there was a pretty stunning referendum where the voters did reject the deal. But what we saw after that was, for the first time, European leaders coming out and brandishing the possibility of a Grexit, or a Greek exit from the euro, for the first time ever publicly. Basically, both sides came all the way to the brink. And there was a lot of fear. There was also a kind of a bit of a clash or divide between Germany and France over whether to just let Greece go and get this over with, or whether the European project was important enough over the long term that, you know, the union needs to be kept together. At the end of the day, they all chose to keep the union together, but at a pretty steep cost here in Greece.
And that cost is about $80 billion from Germany and France and the other European partners to finance this bailout. But what are the costs to Greeks?
The average Greek is certainly going to be paying for this. And in fact, you know, having basically dragged these negotiations out for the last 5 months has just made things worse. The economy already fell back into a recession in the first quarter, and that most likely persisted in the second quarter. And the bailout package, which was originally estimated, the Greeks had asked for $50 billion, now, as you say, has risen to more than $80 billion, because the damage to the economy, including from having had the banks closed now for the last 2 weeks, has been so severe that it's going to take that much more money to get them on their feet. And it now remains to be seen whether Mr. Tsipras will be able to actually hold on to power after all of this.
When will people begin feeling the pain and a backlash, if there is expected to be one? When could that occur?
Well, right now, the promises that the banks would open up today have gone unfulfilled. There's a lot of talk that the banks might possibly not open up for almost another month or so. Capital controls would still remain in place if the banks do open. And, you know, you're talking about people who are trying to live by standing in long lines and getting, you know, 50 or 60 euros every day out of the ATM machine. The economy has basically kind of been cratering at a faster rate because there's just not enough money going around. And in the meantime, the Greek people, especially pensioners, are looking at a harder future than what was envisioned before Mr. Tsipras had exhorted the country to vote no to the original package. We also even heard the Europeans saying that they might consider flying in some humanitarian aid to this country, which a lot of people say is a pretty stunning statement. It's something they basically haven't heard since the Second World War.
Liz Alderman, chief European business correspondent for The New York Times. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This hour, we will show you two remarkable examples of how networks of social media and the proliferation of high-quality digital cell phone cameras are changing our view of the world. We will take you into a world that you could only see in a collage of selfies and quick-hit candids, a feature film about the underside of L.A. called Tangerine. But our first example is a powerful real-life look inside ISIS, a place where basically no reporters can go, where no message gets out but for the propaganda messages ISIS wants told to the world. An amazing new frontline documentary has managed to break through the wall around ISIS. It tells the story of a secret underground network that uses cell phones to locate captured women and to document the unholy brutality they have endured. This young woman is named Aida. She was imprisoned in a warehouse for months.
I wish I could forget that building. We were around 35 girls and 3 women. I was only 21, but I was the oldest. They were coming and taking girls from this building. We had one guard who was forcing a 9-year-old girl. He was forcing her to go with him to the bathroom. I couldn't take it, and I had a fight with the guard. The guard said, "I will kill you." And I said, "I don't mind dying for her. Don't take the girl."
Edward Watts is the director and producer of the new Frontline film produced by our partner WGBH. It's called Escaping ISIS, and it airs on PBS tomorrow night. Watts found women enslaved, tortured, and brainwashed into doing the bidding of ISIS. He also found a network of brave fighters and rescuers like nothing he had ever seen before. And they showed him images and told stories that, we should warn you, are disturbing.
We had to rely really on an enormous group of very brave people inside who've dedicated their lives, who risk their lives on a daily basis to show the reality of what life is like inside ISIS. I mean, I think another problem that we all face to really show the truth is just this propaganda machine that ISIS put out, which we're all aware of, but which portray them as this sort of invincible army, as their, you know, their area is very well run, as people are being happy at their rule. And I think that what the activist footage and what we learn from the film, what I hope you learn from the film, is that that propaganda really is just that propaganda, and that the reality is very different on all counts. One of which, very importantly, I think, being that ISIS are not nearly as strong as they might like us to believe.
And this is conveyed through pictures that were taken by cell phone cameras, often, you know, upside down, you know, jerky pictures, but absolutely fascinating stuff. Explain how this cell phone network is kind of the lifeline.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really an extraordinary story. I think it's comparable with stories that we hear from the Second World War of the French resistance operating in occupied France, where you have this network inside ISIS territory that really, they depend on phones, in the sense of these mobile phones are the lifeline for people who are trapped inside ISIS or working inside their territory to communicate. And the phone is one of the most precious commodities there for these people who are held captive. So they often smuggle them out at the point of being caught, or they try and steal them from their ISIS captors. And once they get hold of these phones, the way that the process works in terms of the rescues is that they will call their families, and the families are aware of these guys that we were filming with who are doing everything they can to try and help people escape. And essentially that's how the whole process begins. It all begins with one phone call.
Well, it's absolutely amazing, and you never would imagine that a phone call or cell phones could be so riveting to watch. And let's meet some of the characters. Here's a woman by the name of Nadia.
Two of my friends electrocuted themselves. One hanged herself with her shawl. One woman slit her wrist. She went to the bathroom, and we saw the blood leaking from under the door. They said they would feed her to the dogs. That is the fate of anyone who kills themselves.
Now, that is testimony from Nadia, one of the captives of ISIS, who are in a form of sexual slavery. Can you describe Nadia a little bit for us?
Yes, she was a very young, highly intelligent woman. I mean, a lot of these women who were taken by ISIS, they are really young. She was, I think, about 18, and she'd been captured, you know, snatched from her family. They're held in these extraordinary conditions. She'd been held for over 100 days in the hands of ISIS, seen all these atrocities that you hear about. You just heard a little taste of the kind of things that she went through there. And she had managed to escape on her own, just through her own ingenuity, managed to get back to safety, and was now taking a next courageous decision to actually speak about what had happened, what she'd seen, and to tell the world, really, about what is actually happening for these girls inside.
And then there's Khalil al-Dakhi, who's a Yazidi man, a very brave lawyer, who's helping women to escape who can't make it on their own. Let's listen to him.
It can take a whole month to rescue one family or sometimes one person. It's very difficult. They're being raped and mistreated on a daily basis. They're calling, crying. They're asking us to rescue them, telling us they can't cope any longer. It's very painful. There's no one else they can ask for help because their family is either taken or killed.
Tell me about Khalil and just what he's managed to do here.
Well, he's an extraordinary individual. I mean, he's the head, really, of a small team of guys. There are probably about eight of them in total who are doing this work. And all of them come from different backgrounds. Khalil was a lawyer. I mean, he was dealing with things like relatively mundane civil law, like marriages, divorces, just very basic stuff. But when this attack happened, he began to apply his skills as a lawyer to trying to gather the testimony together of what had happened to the Yazidis during the attack on the Sinjar Mountain. And then, as some of the women and girls started to come back, he began to gather their testimony, a record of what they'd experienced. In the hope, initially, I think, he was hoping that it would provide evidence for a war crimes trial, which he still hopes to see, I think, of some of these ISIS guys. But, you know, through his own ingenuity, he really realized that the information that these women were bringing back actually gave you an extraordinary picture inside ISIS. It allowed you to really get a map of their territory and understanding of how they were deployed. And most importantly for him, where the women and girls were being held, which towns they were particularly being held in, even down to specific buildings where they were concentrated. And that information was obviously incredibly helpful for anyone who was trying to get them out. And that was how this whole process began. I mean, he himself describes it as a do-it-yourself operation. They'd really just done it off their own back, using their own wits to work out how you might be able to get these women out. And he's dedicated his life to doing that now. So he's really a hero for our times, I think.
Khalil is a Yazidi, and the Yazidis are one of the oppressed groups in ISIS territory, but they're by no means the only one. You could have told this story through the eyes of any of the groups that are taken captive by ISIS.
Yeah, you could. I mean, I think the Yazidis, what I hope the film does is it sort of shows you the two ends of the spectrum for women in particular who are living under ISIS. So at one end, you have the Yazidis who are, though ISIS have taken Christians, you're right, and they've imprisoned Shias, no one is quite regarded in the same way as almost subhuman in the way that ISIS regard the Yazidis. And it's that particular categorization that allows them to treat the women as sex slaves, as objects, you know, as chattels, basically. So you have, that is the extreme end of the experience. But then at the other end, which also you see in the program, is what it's like for Muslim women there. Because, I mean, that's a real thing that I think is often forgotten. There are an estimated 4 million Muslim women living in under the Islamic State. And prior to ISIS arriving, their version of Islam wasn't anything like as extreme as ISIS's version. They were educated, they were free to move around, and now those women have to abide by these incredibly harsh laws that ISIS have imposed. So I guess what we were trying to do is, by focusing on Muslim women and on the Yazidis, was to give you an understanding of the spectrum of experience, all of it very, very tough. And the scale of it is unique, I think, in modern times, of just this, the sheer cruelty that these guys are capable of. I've made 20 documentaries now about lots of horrendous things happening around the world, and I've never come across anything like it.
Edward Watts is director and producer of Frontline's Escaping ISIS. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
We have in America an elaborate judicial system to protect the rights of the accused, with checks on government power. It oversees the arrest, trial, and sentencing of citizens who become criminal defendants in America. And it is that system that is responsible for the more than 2.5 million people behind bars. But who decides on parole for those convicts? Who sets the terms of release for the more than 4.8 million people on probation or parole? It turns out that it is the 50 state parole boards across the country, each with their own rules, and in more than half the states with nearly unlimited power over who gets out of prison, when, and why. Tom Grant is a former New York State Parole Board member from 2004 to 2010 who, along with Beth Schwartzapfel of the Marshall Project, undertook a month-long investigation into parole and criminal justice reform. The findings have been published by the Washington Post. Reporter Schwartzapfel says one way to think about a parole hearing is to think of it as a constitution-free zone.
As a general rule, there are no due process rights in front of a parole board. And that's because courts have found that prisoners who go before a parole board don't have what's called a liberty interest. Since they're not already free, they don't have any freedom to lose. And by not having freedom to lose, they lose the due process rights that come with the risk of losing your freedom.
Is there anything in the parole system, Tom, in your experience, which would prevent something like somebody who works in the corrections department has a vendetta against a particular prisoner for something that has nothing to do with their behavior and wants to make sure this fella never gets out on parole to prevent that sort of thing from being abused? Is there anything like that? Or can somebody just make a phone call and basically their parole will be denied?
Well, interestingly, in New York, just to digress a little bit, the state legislature has generally been very reluctant to enact statutes or pass statutes and have the governor sign them relative specifically to parole. A lot of the parole policies and regulations in New York are the result of court cases filed by inmates and their attorneys expressing a concern about examples such like you just gave, where you'd have a guard or a corrections officer put something in a parole applicant's file that could negatively impact their appearance before the parole board. It would be a report, say a misbehavior report, which would go through the correction system, which would indicate that an inmate or a parole board applicant has not done very well inside from a behavior point of view.
And I will say in some states, you will get letters both from corrections officials and also from politicians. I know, for instance, in Alabama, the governor, the attorney general, a lot of the elected officials in that state are known to write letters in opposition to parole. And the parole board members told me personally that those letters carry great weight, even if those people don't have any personal knowledge of that particular case. And I will also say this is why transparency matters so much, that in 25 states, the contents of the file, basically the records, the letters and things the board uses to make its decision, are not open to the public. And in 19 states, they're not even open to the inmate himself.
Are there any objective criteria for what constitutes a approval for parole? You're being approved because of X, Y, and Z. Is it like that?
A lot of states now do have parole guidelines, but they're almost always advisory. So the board is free to depart from those guidelines for almost any reason.
The interpretation of the criteria can even vary among different parole panels within a state. You might come before, as an offender, might become before a parole board of people with maybe law enforcement backgrounds or prosecutorial backgrounds in 1 month, and your bunkmate might come up before a parole board the next month with the panel consisting maybe a social worker or non-law enforcement backgrounds. So there's a real confusion. You could have situations, again, obviously nothing is identical, but you could have people who are incarcerated who have committed very similar crimes, have very similar records within the correctional system, have a very similar release plan, and one could be denied and one could be granted release. It's a very arbitrary, at least on the surface, system that really defies explanation. In New York, there are three general factors that a parole board is required to consider by law. First off, would release at this particular time be incompatible with the welfare of society? The second criteria, is there a reasonable probability that if the person were released at this time, that they would remain at liberty without violating the law? And then the final one, would release at this time so deprecate the nature of the offense as to undermine respect for the law? These are incredibly vague criteria and can be interpreted in many different ways by sitting parole panels.
Beth, would you say that the deliberations in parole often or largely amount to a kind of have you been punished enough sort of discussion?
That's almost always one of the elements of the conversation. But a lot of people I spoke to in my reporting raised the question, the judge knew what the offense was when he or she sentenced this person however many decades ago. And even knowing that offense, they were sentenced to a sentence that made them parole eligible after a certain amount of time. So you would think that the seriousness of the offense is already built into the sentence that they received. Why should then the parole board again consider the same crime when the judge already knew that?
What are the qualifications to be on a parole board in New York, and what have you found around the country?
New York college degree, basically a law enforcement type background or social sciences type background, and commensurate work experience. And then you have to be nominated by the governor and confirmed by the state senate. So there's indeed a political aspect to the job of parole board.
And nationally?
Nationally, the requirements to be a parole board member are very spotty from one state to the next. Some states, like New York, have pretty good, you know, basic requirements. Other states have zero basic requirements. Or if they do have requirements, they're sort of advisory in nature. They'll say a parole board member should have X number of years of experience. Or the fields that they dictate that the person should have experience in are vague and broad, like education or medicine. I saw a number of parole board members around the country who say were a high school English teacher, where they fit those minimum requirements. But, you know, one could ask, how is that person well positioned to understand the complexities of criminal behavior, of risk assessments, of what the different disciplinary proceedings mean within prison, all the things that you need to know to make good decisions?
What about the volume? How many cases are these boards seeing, and how extensive are the deliberations?
Well, New York is at an interesting crossroads, because over the last decade and a half, New York has moved from an indeterminate sentence where you'd have a minimum and a maximum, and you would first see a parole board at the minimum, to a more determinate sentencing structure, where if you were sentenced to, say, 20 years, you would serve your 20 years minus generally 15% for good behavior. The interesting thing about that is that you could have people who've committed the same crimes, where some person in a determinate sentence would be incarcerated and released, another person is sentenced under an indeterminate sentencing structure, requiring him or her to see a parole board, and they're still incarcerated because they've been denied frequently by multiple parole boards. So here's a 7-minute interview, maybe, for somebody who's been incarcerated for 25 years. Is that right? Is that fair? So it's kind of a system that doesn't make any sense. And people just keep scratching their heads, both inside and outside. Is the system broken? Does it make any sense these days?
Beth Schwartz-Appel, a staff writer at the Marshall Project, and Tom Grant is a former New York State Parole Board member from 2004 to 2010. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks
for having us.
Appreciate it.
Great.
If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
We took the power away from the Washington-based special interest, and we put it in the hands of the Wisconsin taxpayers.
We tell our country, and we tell people all across the globe, that voters really do want leaders who stand up and make the tough decisions.
I'm running to win. I think I've got a good campaign to win.
I want a commander-in-chief who will do everything in their power to ensure that the threat from radical Islamic terrorists do not wash up in American soil. We need a leader with that kind of confidence.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker.
He's the Tea Party darling, and today he makes it official, putting a smile on the faces of many of the hardcore conservatives in the Republican base. On the day of his public announcement that he's running for president, Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin, is polling reasonably well. But he will compete with some other colorful candidates in the ring for the conservative vote, and with little experience outside of his state, Walker has some convincing to do to get the support of centrist voters. Mordecai Lee is a professor of urban planning at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's also a former state senator. Professor Lee joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Welcome.
Thank you.
How long have you been watching Walker? And he comes from, I guess you might say, humble roots, didn't finish college, that sort of thing.
I've known him since the mid-90s when he was a freshman member of the state assembly. And I have to say that his rise meets his talents. He was, even back then, an intuitive, fabulous politician.
In the sense that he knew how to, you know, charm people in a room, get a group on his side, win people over?
That you'd expect in just about every politician. I think what Scott Walker excels at is that he agrees with the positions of talk radio. He's a very ideological conservative. But when we think of talk radio or we think of the Tea Party, we think of anger and meanness and high-pitched voices. Scott Walker's secret sauce is that he's a talk radio conservative, but without the anger, without the heat. Rather, he comes across, when he justifies his positions, in a very low-key, reasonable manner that one would not realize that he actually is. He could just as easily be Rush Limbaugh.
So he has a kind of warmth and a certain kind of charm, and you think that that's going to translate nationally. Do you think he's a classic populist in economic terms?
I don't think he's a classic populist. I think he's a classic Tea Party talk radio conservative. So I'll give you an example of what I meant by his secret sauce. When he first got elected governor, Wisconsin had just gotten something like $850 million from the stimulus bill to build a high-speed train between Milwaukee and Madison. And talk radio and Tea Party conservatives were vehemently against it, denouncing it as a waste of money, as something that wouldn't work, as something that would be a white elephant. He was by now the governor-elect, and he said that he too was against taking the money from the federal government. But he explained that the only reason he was against it is because he thought it was possible there might be a need for operating subsidies from the state to keep it going once it was built. So in other words, he agreed with talk radio, he agreed with the Tea Party, but he gave this very soft and gentle explanation for his position.
And would you say he translates in the West and in the South?
I think he's going to come across very well. I think he's going to come across as, I'm like you. I'm middle class like you. I have a house. I have a mortgage. I have two boys who are now in college. My wife only works part-time. I bag lunch every day. In other words, he's going to sound to swing voters and to middle-class voters and to Democratic voters like one of them. That is the secret of how he got elected governor of Wisconsin, that he didn't talk about social issues. You wouldn't even know that he had a position on abortion. All he talked about was that he knew how to create jobs and that he promised he could create a quarter of a million jobs in his first term. Now, he didn't, and in fact, no politician does, left or right. But then the policies that he implemented fulfilled the conservative dogma of cutting taxes on businesses, holding spending limits on expenditures by the government, cutting regulations, signing pro-business legislation. It was, I think, a revelation to the people who were swing voters in the middle who hadn't realized that of his positions.
I've seen him work a room in some of these conservative groups in Washington, like the Americans for Prosperity, that sort of thing. I mean, he is just beloved by groups like that. How would you say Scott Walker stacks up against this Donald Trump thunderbolt that suddenly entered the race, in the sense that Trump is polling pretty well, actually a little better than Scott Walker right now?
Well, sometimes in politics, it's best not to be the front runner because everybody takes their shots at the front runner. But I think we need to focus on the fact that Walker is a fabulous politician, whether, you know, not talking about his substantive positions, but he really reminds me of Bill Clinton as governor of Arkansas running for president. And again, by mentioning Clinton, I'm not trying to invoke anything other than his political skills. But Scott Walker is intuitive. He's fleet-footed. He thinks on his feet. He's disciplined. He never says what he doesn't want to say. He can read a situation. It's just all the skills that make for an impressive politician.
So in a face-to-face sort of debate with Donald Trump, Walker would have no problem at all.
Oh, I can't imagine any problem. And I think he would stand out amongst the other candidates who are seeking to win over the religious right or the Tea Party factions of the Republican Party, in the sense that he'll come across as reasonable and seemingly moderate. And so I think that is a winning formula for him to succeed and win the nomination. And I think he's pretty got a decent chance of winning the presidency.
Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's a former state senator in Wisconsin. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
We've already seen how when we take out our cell phones and turn on their cameras, it can reveal the inner realities of even a hyper-secretive group like ISIS. Millions of people with cell phones and cameras can catch life in a way no ordinary camera can. The iPhone camera becomes such an eye in a new film called Tangerine. This fictional feature film is set in the rarely examined world of transsexual prostitutes in Los Angeles. The story starts with the rumor that Chester is cheating on his girl, who just got out of prison.
So, I got some good news to tell you.
What?
I've been keeping a secret about me and Chester.
Girl. I know what it is. Oh, you're girl. Breaking up with him. Thank God. Because, what? Honey, for what? Him to be cheating
what?
Like that.
Wait. What?
You didn't know?
As a tale of infidelity, Tangerine will never be confused with Shakespeare's Othello. But this little movie has grand aspirations, and that is part of the charm that made it a huge hit at Sundance this year. Director Sean Baker stuck to his guns, or his iPhones, and star James Ransom eventually came on board, even though he quickly learned an iPhone shoot is not like being on the big-budget set of Titanic.
You know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've worked on really big-budget stuff, and I thought, oh my God, I'm shooting on a phone, like where did I make a wrong step in my career? But to some degree, Tangerine is the promise of what people have been talking about for, I think, the last couple of years with the democratization of creativity in terms of everybody has access to technology that they didn't, you know, 15 years ago. And so how can you use that to create something new? But yet at the same time, we just took like almost like a really classic Hollywood story structure and just turned it on its head, the way that I see it.
It's a British farce almost.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you say that because it's actually very influenced by, do you know the work of Mike Lee?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and his films High Hopes and Secrets and Lies. We really structured that the whole ending of the film in which our ensemble cast of characters converge at donut time for a big confrontation.
And, you know, that's what's touching because the movie flows out of this sense of chaos to these very directed moments of poignance and intensity. And did that happen as you were filming? Is that deliberate in the script? How much of this was predicted?
We call it a scriptment because it's half a script, half a treatment. It comes in around 70 pages, and sometimes dialogue is fleshed out and sometimes it isn't. I always encourage my actors to improvise, and I'm lucky enough to have surrounded myself with incredibly talented improvisers. I always say this. I say if we can actually control about 70% of what's going on, 30% is left up in the air for happy accidents, for whatever may come our way. And sometimes, you know, we run into problems, but other times we're extremely happy with what comes our way and what we find is what I'm trying to say.
There's something ultimately liberating about being freed completely from the traditional Hollywood process. I mean, you don't have to sell a script, right?
We actually got approval on our treatment through our executive producers, Mark and Jay Duplass, who are two, you know, independent film right. gurus right now. And they're just like these incredibly supportive producers. And they were just, they almost gave me the thumbs up just when I said, I want to make a film about Santa Monica and Highland. And then a little bit down the line, when we actually were very close to deciding whether or not to shoot on the iPhone, it was Mark Duplass who sort of gave me the pat on the back and the thumbs up saying, why not? It's punk rock. Go for it. So they were sort of our studio heads, but extremely hands-off supportive studio heads.
Do you find that people are more predisposed to being filmed? I guess L.A. is a different place than anywhere in the world, but is there something about the iPhone and the way that you do the production? For instance, that line, that food line.
Yeah.
Everyone's just sort of like ready to go and ready to be a part of it, right?
Well, oh no, those were all.
Those are actors. All actors. Every single one of them.
Yes. And
even
all
Bob?
Oh, yeah. Well, Bob we got from Craigslist. We actually cast.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We cast in very unconventional ways because we didn't have the money for a casting director.
Yeah.
So we reached out to people through Craigslist, through Vine, through Instagram, YouTube, and, of course, the actors I've already worked with. So it was a real – and, of course, street casting, which is how we found Maya and how we found Kiki.
There's actually a lot of unlimited resources in the digital space if you have the patience sort of to comb through it. That weren't available to us 20 years ago, you know, in order to make, tell the story that you want to tell. I mean, even the way that the soundtrack, the way that the movie was scored was curated by Sean going over Vine videos and then reaching
SoundCloud.
Out. Yeah, and then reaching out to the artist directly via SoundCloud.
Except for Beethoven, right?
That was actually a public domain track. It was
nice.
So we were very lucky to find that one.
That's great. In this post, Caitlyn Jenner moment, and you've been to Sundance, what's the reaction as to how well you've nailed this world, this scene, this sense of characters? Any ideas there?
So far, all of the press has been really, really positive, but it'll be interesting how the public sort of reacts to it. And
but the people who have seen it at festivals, we've been... So far, we've been getting a lot of love, and this is from everybody, including members of the trans community who've reached out to us, and they're very appreciative of the film. So, you know, so far, so good.
I also think it needs to be said that anything that provokes a conversation in the mainstream about the realities of what a lot of transgender sex workers have to go through on a day-to-day basis, especially those of color, and if you look at the data, the statistical data, regardless of the story, a lot of Black and Latina trans sex workers come from households of median incomes of less than $10,000, and you know, and they're the fastest growing rate of HIV in this country, and their day-to-day life is actually pretty harsh because a lot of them actually want to buy hormones, and they're very expensive to procure, and because it's really difficult for them to find jobs based on gender bias, then they have to turn to sex work in order to pay for their hormones. So, I mean, all that information is readily available on the internet if you go look at it. But if that makes its way into the conversation, I think it's a very important I think we've done a very important thing.
Sean Baker is the writer and director of Tangerine. James Ransom is one of the stars of the film. It's currently in limited release. So here's something to take with you. Before you start on your cell phone movie treatment, you better find a quiet place to work, undistracted. I mean it. And good luck. Researchers at Florida State University suggest that even the tiniest millisecond of a phone vibration is enough to break your concentration. And forget about ignoring your phone if it's in your office. This research says that simply receiving the notification is distracting enough. Quote, our results suggest that mobile phones can disrupt attention performance even if one does not interact with the device, write the study's authors. As mobile phones become integrated into more and more tasks, it may, they say, become increasingly difficult for people to set their phones aside and concentrate fully on the task at hand, whatever it may be. And I say to them, welcome to planet Earth. So put the phone in the freezers, kids, and get to work this summer on something big. That's all for today. You can ask me anything on Twitter. Every day I take your questions, sometimes your complaints, and I do my best to get back to you personally. You can find me at Jay Hockenberry. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. Allow us to distract you. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.